Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 12, delivered on October 1, 2015. The title of this lecture is Bond Price Dynamics.
Today, Bond Price Dynamics. As we approach the midterm, I want to advise you that I am telegraphing the questions I will ask you on the midterm during the lectures, so it's worth your while to write things down, listen to the podcast, because I am telling you quite a few of the questions as we go along, and we will do a full review the day before the exam, of course, but keep your ears open as we talk about the topics moving along. In the textbook, there are some definitions in Chapter 6 that are, they sort of make them sound like they are finance or specific to this particular topic at hand, but they're actually wider, larger, or more commonly used terms. One of those that's in the textbook, and I want to give you an idea that it is actually a more broadly used term than what's in the textbook, is the term spot. Tell you where I first heard this term. Well, I had all this education, and I went out into the world of consulting while I was teaching, and I was down in Texas doing oil and gas exploration with some people down there, and we would essentially bring together the money to drill a well somewhere where we had a feeling or had some information that there was might be some oil down in the ground, not gushers or anything, but there might be some oil down there. So we'd punch holes in the earth, and once in a while we'd get something, nothing spectacular, but when you bring it out of the ground, you're going to put it into these reserve tanks, and then you're going to work with one of the companies, like Cocaline, comes around every now and then and takes the oil out of the reserve tanks and pays you for the oil that you've pulled out of the ground. Well, there were two ways that you could get paid for the oil. You could take spot, or you could do a forward contract. Spot meant that whatever the prevailing price was, you were going to get paid that price. So if you were selling on spot, that would mean that if the price of oil went up, you would benefit from that. Price of oil goes down, you get punished. A forward contract, however, you would arrange that there would be a guaranteed price over the over say 6 months, and you would be paid that price for every barrel of oil that the Cocaline truck pulled out of your reserve tanks. So you take spot or do a forward contract. Now the forward contract was kind of a raw deal. It wasn't a great amount of money, but it was certainly you knew what you were going to get. That was it was right there. But the spot was far more speculative, and you could win or you could lose on that kind of a deal. That was where I first heard the term spot. Now, interestingly enough, these were speculators, and they went spot, and it was okay. The price of oil was fairly stable in that time period. It went down a little bit, but it wasn't anything terrible. And to be honest, we did a little bit better that way than we would have on a forward. It just depends on your risk. But the term spot is essentially what it means is the now, the right now price or rate or whatever. So you might actually run into this in your business lives if you haven't already, the term spot, especially in commodities markets, but also in financial securities markets too. And this is where the book picks up the term. to refer to the now price of a security. So let's say you had a BCT. Oh, let's see. Let's say it's an 8%, 2040. Yeah, and this marker isn't doing any better than the other one in here, 2045. I apologize for this. This is just crap. That's a BCT, 8%, 2045. That's a trading symbol, BCT. 8% is a coupon based upon face of $1,000. Remember I said, unless I say otherwise, face is $1,000, and it is due in 2045, which means that that one is a long, it's probably just, it's new issue, it's a 30-year term to maturity. 30-year term to maturity. It's probably a new issue kind of security. Okay, so let's say that the market anticipates that the risk of this debt instrument is commensurate with a yield to maturity. Really? With a yield to maturity, a YTM. You know, this is really bunching my boxers. Let's try it this way. Let's try all programs. Let me go to, I see a Microsoft Office. I'm going to do this in Word. Let's go with a nice fat font. Bold. Okay. BCT 8% 2045. Okay. Well, goody. There we go. Now maybe I can do this. Okay. Anyway, I'm putting up a, so let's say it's a BCT 8% 2045. That would mean that the term of the bond is 30 years. It's probably new issue. 30 years sounds like a new maturity issue. And it's 8%, so we are going to say, let's say that the market anticipates that this bond should be yielding, 7.8%. Okay. Now, no, I don't want to capitalize that. Okay, right off the bat, is this bond, sir, going to sell at a discount or a premium to par? Premium. In fact, it will, because the market says you have to pay only 7.8%. You're so generous, you're going to give us 8%. Well, isn't that nice of you? The bond buyers will flow in and buy this, putting demand pressure on it, push the price up. This is a deal. This is a good deal. There you go. So, that's nice. So let's figure out, let's get the price of this little mother, or this little thing here. So it's 30 years, but remember, every bond pays twice a year, so it's 60 periods, and that'll be N. And then the yield, the interest over Y, remember that we're going to have to divide that in 2, so it's 7.8 divided by 2. If you're putting it in, divide it. If it's coming out, multiply it by 2. Again, if you are putting it in, divide it by 2. If you are taking it out, multiply the result by 2. And there we have the yield to maturity. Now, the payments are going to be 8% on face of $1,000. So that's $80 a year. But remember, that comes in 2 increments, twice a year, $40 on each of the payments. Don't ever forget to do that. And also, don't forget that the bond will pay off its face value at the end. The face value, 1,000. And so from there, it's just a matter of compute the price. And sure enough, 102306. 102306. Let me 102306. 102306. 1023.06. So this bond is quoting at 102.31. Make sure you see that. The bond is quoting at 102.31. That's the spot. That's spot. Spot on the bond is 102.31. It's just a term. It makes you sound really cool when you say, well, spot is 102.31. Nothing major about that. Now, we can do a lot of different securities here, but let me show you something real quick here. Now, this was assuming that we were in 2015. Let's see what spot is if the same conditions were around and we were now. That's cool, it made an arrow. That's sweet. Oh, sorry, that's small things, yeah. Let's say we're now at 20,040. The same conditions, 60. The same conditions, yield to maturity is still the same as it was. The bond's not going to change its basic covenants. Let's see what the price is. Price equals. Well, we take this down, and let's change that. That means it's got 5 years left, so that would be 10 payments left. Everything else would be the same on this bond, like I said. The market still thinks that there's this spread. Okay, one more. Okay, that's nice. So let's compute the price. Oh. 108.15. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? You see, bonds get closer to par the closer the term gets to maturity. Bonds get closer to par. It doesn't matter whether they're at a discount or a premium. The idea being that there are fewer and fewer payments left. There is less risk left in the remaining payments. So bonds naturally will tend, whether they are above par or below par, they will tend to converge on par value. Think about it this way. Suppose that we are at 2045, just a few minutes before the bond pays off. Now, if the bond is going to pay off, let's say, in 15 minutes, whoever has it gets $1,000. So regardless of what kind of a yield to maturity it had, it's going to cost $1,000 to get $1,000 in 15 minutes. So all bonds, whether they're above or below par, converge on par. There's one exception to that, and I'll bring that up in just a minute. But keep that in mind when I'm asking you questions on an exam. A question like, what is the relationship between the price of a bond and the term of the bond? In other words, how long it has until it matures? Well, the answer would be, as the term approaches zero, the bond approaches par. That's all you say. If you say more than that, I will start taking off points because you're showing me that you don't understand. This is a compact answer, and that's what's wanted in the business world. Not essays, not these 50-page essays some professors hand you to do. We want quick, straight answers. Show me that you know what you're doing. Now, moving along here, there is one exception. I should point this out. If a company has gone tap city, the bond is essentially, there are all kinds of terms for these. The one I like is zombie bonds. A bond that is out there, the company is dead, it's been dead. Well, that bond is going to collapse. It's going to converge on zero. You see, because essentially there's no company left. The company's dead. So in that case, a bond could approach a value of zero as the term approaches maturity. Give you an example. There are a couple of retailers out there right now that are really struggling. Both of them, in my judgment, are going to survive, but they're, in my judgment as an analyst, but you would see right now their bonds, even the ones that are relatively close to maturity, are still way below par because there's a lot of speculation whether they'll actually pay off or not. So those are going to sit there just kind of flopping around, and as they get closer and closer, they're just going to either boom up to 1,000 or boom down to zero. But it's not, so for some bonds, it's not a smooth path. But also understand this. Another important point about this is that bonds that have longer term, in other words, there's a longer time until they mature, are more interest rate sensitive. All other things being equal, they're more interest rate sensitive. This goes back to that description I gave you. You, sir, you've used a bullwhip before, right? Sure you have. Now, there are these ones that are very short. In order to get a good twack out of it, you have to give it a la la. But you prefer the 30-footer. That one that you just go, and at the end of it, don't do that, Carl. Okay. Indeed. So the point there being that there is more time for risk to articulate on a long-term basis. You'll see more of a whipsaw on a bond that is long. So if you want bonds, which are relatively safer than stocks in a lot of cases, but you do want some volatility, you want to play the volatility angle and the price going up and down, you would probably reach for longer-term bonds, bonds that still had a lot of time left to maturity so that they had that whipsaw that you might actually like to speculate on. But the shorter the term, the less likely. And also, one thing that's, I don't know if this would be clear, you can just practice with some exercises. Zero coupon bonds, they are always going to be more volatile price-wise than coupon paying bonds. Essentially because you're loading the whole payoff out here. So when interest rates pop up and down, wow, that makes that ZCB just hop all over the place, okay? So let me show you an example. Let me do this one right here. I'm going to show you an example. Let's take two bonds. One of them is CRP. Oh, let's do 6%. Oh, 2022. And let's start with a YTM of, seriously, will you stop trying to correct my frickin' writing? It just rotates my ass when it, okay. Well, let's take it, let's do this one. Let's say it's 6.4% is the yield to maturity on it, to start it out. The price of that one, starting out, and this will take just a minute to do, what was that? 7 years, so that's 14 payments left on N. The YTM, what did I say? 6.4, what was it I said? 6.4%, 6.4 divided by 2. And I'm doing this partly so you can see this over and over again, get comfortable with it. And what was the, whoops, okay, 6.4%. I want to do 6.4 divided by 2 equals, I forgot to hit the equal sign, I over Y. And the payments are $30 every 6 months. That's the payment. Kicker is $1,000. Okay, so now compute the price value. It's $977.71. That's spot. Now, let's say that interest rates push up to, oh, I don't know, let's do 6.6%. And let's see the price again. And everything else would be the same on it. Seriously? Everything else would be the same on it. So we'll get a price on it here. Say at 6.6%, we would just put in 6.6 divided by 2 into the yield to maturity. And we would get a price on it of $966.79. Nothing big about that. However, let's do an equal bond. Let's say CRP actually at the same time has out there that animal. What is that? What did I just put up there? What do you call that? Do you know? Start. Madam, what is that number in the middle there between CRP and 2022? Say it again.
Zero.
Don't be afraid. Yeah, that is a zero. And what does that number in the middle represent? The
interest.
The
interest.
No, the woman? The coupon. Yeah, it is a payment, but I mean, that's so, you know, Decatur. It's a coupon. Damn it. Okay. That just frosts the fringe on my boxers when it does that. Why? There. Let's figure out the yield to maturity on this little son of a dog here. Now, in order to do that, you have to use that zero coupon bond formula for this guy. Remember that the yield to maturity, YTM, oh, no, let's do it backwards. Let's not do the yield. Let's do just 6.4%. This bond should pay 6.4%. Okay, yield to maturity is 6.4%. So let's just do the price. And that would be that formula, YTM. That would be that formula, YTM equals, do you remember how the formula went? $1,000 divided by the price, the spot, all to the 1 over n power, like that. That sucks the way I wrote that there, but that's the formula. Okay. So in order to do this, we would have to do some fancy formulas, and I'm not really concerned that you can do this. I would have to do the yield to maturity, YTM to the nth power, both sides raising it to the nth power, and then that would equal 1,000 divided by P, and then you cross multiply so that what you would get is the price would equal the 1,000 divided by YTM to the nth power. Now, again, don't worry so much about the formula. What I want you to do is notice what's going to happen to the price of this little sucker. If I were to work that out, the price would come out to be 1,000 divided by 0.064 price would equal 1,000 divided by the yield to maturity. I didn't do something. I apologize for this. Minus 1. I knew there was something wrong with my formula. So that would be plus 1 in the parentheses. Thought that was going to come out really nasty, YTM plus 1. And again, I'm not really too interested in you. 0.064 plus 1 to the 7th power. Now, if I were to do that on my calculator, I'm trying to get to a point here, the way around the long way. Saying, okay, calculator. Now, if I do that, I'm going to do 1,000, divided by 1.064 to the to the 7th power. And if you work that out, that will come out to be 647.75. What would happen, though, if the interest rate went to 6.6%? Doing the problem again. And I'm just going to throw it in. Don't worry about calculating. I'm trying to make, again, a point here. The price would come out to be 1,000 divided by 1,000 divided by 1.066 to the price comes out to be 639.29. The point I'm making here is notice that a bump of 0.2% brought this bond down $8. It brought this bond down $11. Isn't that an interesting result? Let that sink in for a little bit here. And I won't comment much further on it. Now I'm going to take you into another world completely here, just for a while. And I'll get rid of this calculator in a minute here. But I want to take you into another term that the book uses. Credit risk. I'm going to have to use just that word. Seriously, all programs. Microsoft. word. Try it again. Okay, the term that I'm going to bring up now, and I'm going to show you in real time what this term means, credit risk. Credit risk. Credit risk is a spread or between a riskless instrument and a risky instrument of otherwise being identical. So to take you into this world, I'm going to show you some quotes. This is FINRA. Now, a lot of people, surprisingly, many people who are majoring in finance don't know what FINRA is. FINRA is sort of like this underlying, very large, very powerful organization, like a self-policing body, an information clearinghouse, has all kinds of things that it does. We're talking about having some reps come here because they're looking for people for jobs in FINRA, finance and accounting people. I'm a lot of finance people, but most people don't know. And I didn't even know until recently that they've started offering bond quotes themselves. So let me show you something here. Let's see. I'm kind of interested in, I would like a bond that's a AAA, a AAA bond. I don't really see anything. Oh yeah, here we go. Here's one right here. Now the yield to maturity on this AAA bond, wow, that kind of sucks. Never mind that. No wonder. Anyway. Let me find something. Bonds. Let's try something. I want to see if I can find. Oh, I'm looking for something that would be, treasury yields. U.S. government bonds. Treasury notes. I'm looking for something very specific here that I can use for this purpose. I'm going to do something awful here. I think I'm going to... seriously? Okay. Okay, bond quotes. FINRA. Well, there's Morningstar. I wonder if I could get a better one. Corporate bond data. Ooh, maybe that. Nope, that's not going to do what I want. Maybe I should just try Morningstar and get it that way. Oh, here we go. Okay. Now, here's a 10-year 2.06. That's the yield on a government bond, a treasury bond. That would be riskless except for a maturity premium. Now, what I would like to do is to say, all right, I got 2.06 spot on a treasury. 2.06 spot on a treasury. Now, let me see if I can get corporate FINRA aggregate statistics. Most active investment grade bonds. Well, let's say... active convertibles. That's okay. That's not bad. We can look at one of these. This is, now, over here, you will see three or two or maybe even one rating in terms, this will be Moody's, S&P, and Fitch rating. Now, Moody, they all have slightly different rating systems. You see this on AT&T, that is investment grade, but it's not extraordinarily high investment grade. So it's one that you would put in a portfolio, but it would have some a little bit of risk to it. Now, if I were to look around here and see if I can find a 10-year in the investment grade, do you see any that are about 10 years out? Oh, did. Okay. I'm just testing your ass there, okay? Okay. 10-year treasury. That was 2.06%. And a 10-year BAA what was that, 3.40%? So the spread is what, 1.34%. The spread is 1.34%. In other words, 134 basis points spread between riskless 10-year and a fairly decent investment grade 10-year, 134 basis points. In other words, that is probably all default premium. The maturity premium would be the same. Obviously, the risk-free rate's the same for the two. The maturity premium would match because they're both 10 years. There's virtually no liquidity premium whatsoever. So that's almost all default premium. Slight reward for having this in your portfolio instead of a treasury. That's a reward to the credit risk you are bearing. That's the reward to the credit risk you're bearing. Now, I want to beat this up a little bit here. I want to try to force this thing, FINRA municipals. See if I can get some of those. Here's what's bothering me here is that the screen that I'm looking at should be showing me what I want, and it's showing me something slightly different from what I want. That's corporate. Okay, agency, well, those are corporate. I'm a little bit flummoxed here because it usually shows a screen that's slightly different, and even Google is acting like it should show that. Okay, bond prices. Okay, let me try something else here. I'm going to try something else completely. This is driving me crazy here. Bond quotes. Let me just get some bond quotes up here. Market Watch should be able to give me Finance Yahoo bonds. Okay, those are treasuries. Okay, so mutual funds, bonds. Huh. Composite bond rates. There. That's a lot better. These are sort of like averages of bonds of certain grades. So now let me look here. Now Yahoo is saying right now a 10-year is going out today, this morning, or at least according to Yahoo, at exactly 2%, a 10-year. So if we look at, say, a corporate bond, high grade, high quality 10-year corporate bond, 2.47. That's a high grade. So in other words, we've got 47 basis points of credit risk spread between the 10-year treasury and the super high qualities. You go down to the double A's, and you got about 100 basis points. You go down to the A's, you got 125 today. Looks like FINRA is actually behind the ball on this. You see them right there? Now, something of interest to me, you can't compare a 30-year treasury because they're not showing you the 30-year corporate equivalents of them. And there are no 20-year treasuries out there. So there you go. But here's an interesting thing. Looking very close at a let's look at a 5-year. A 5-year is quoting on the Treasury at 1.34. On a high-grade corporate 5-year, 1.50. So there's 16 basis points of credit risk spread on that one. Pretty tight. Now let me show you something else up here. Munis, municipal bonds. Municipal bonds are issued by local authorities. Now that could be a city, it could be a school district, it could be some kind of a township, or it could be some other kind of authority that is a sovereign. These are very high grade, they're considered to be pretty high grade bonds. The beauty, the big attraction of them is that the interest, the coupon that you get from a muni is tax-free at the federal level. You don't pay tax on it. Hence, their yields are lower because essentially the yield doesn't have to include the taxes that the investor would have to pay. They have historically been considered to be pretty darn safe. However, there have been defaults on munis. Cleveland, some years back, defaulted on some city bonds. Detroit and others have. So they're considered a little bit risky sometimes because of the potential for default. They can default. But generally speaking, they have been part of wealthier investors, high marginal tax bracket investors' portfolio. For poorer investors, lower income, do not ever buy a muni. It's the stupidest thing in the world because the interest rate on it is keyed to a tax shield for a very high wealth investor. So in other words, if a 6% bond is bought by a high marginal tax rate investor, let's say that investor has a marginal tax rate of let's say 30%, then on the tax bond, they're going to get whacked on that interest pretty hard. But they're not going to get whacked at all on the muni. So there's going to be a big spread there between a genuine 6% bond and one of these munis. A small investor isn't going to benefit from that lower yield at all. So these are a rich people's instrument. Anyway, here's the deal. Don't worry too much about that. We cover that later in the course. But here's the deal. Municipal bonds have been considered Tier 1 capital for banks. Banks are one of the big 800-pound investors in munis. When a school district wants to borrow money, banks will step up to the plate and do it. As a matter of fact, I had a fellow last year speak to the finance club. He was one who made the deals. He did the arrangements between municipal authorities that wanted to borrow money and the big wealthy investors, banks, trusts, things like that, that would do the lending of the money. So banks have historically been a major source of purchase for munis. And they put them in their portfolio because they constitute safe capital. And they help meet the bank's safe capital requirements with banking regulators. Well, the Federal Reserve, just earlier this year, announced that as of, I guess, the end of this year, the munis, the municipal bonds that banks have in their portfolio will no longer be considered safe capital. In other words, banks will have no reason whatsoever to buy these bonds. The greatest major source of money to lend to municipalities for everything from schools to sewers to water to road projects, gone. Why would a bank put money into a muni that yields such crappy by interest rates if it's not going to do anything for their safe capital requirements. So essentially, we are coming up on a major, major crisis in American cities, because cities have to borrow money for long-term capital projects. What they do, there are different ways that they make the arrangements with lenders. Sometimes they say, all right, lenders, we're going to put this tax on, an additional city sales tax on, or a city income tax, for the life of this bond to guarantee that you get your payments. Sometimes it'll be something else, like, for example, when you vote for a school levy, what that is actually doing is you're voting for your property taxes to go up to pay for the bond that is going to be sold to investors to build new schools or something like that. Those are the things that these bonds are used for. So if one of the biggest investors of all, one of the biggest lenders, the banks who buy these munis, are no longer going to be able to count them as safe capital, those banks aren't going to be in the game anymore. So coming next year, cities are going to face a major capital, essentially a credit crunch. There ain't going to be a whole lot of money for them out there, because no one's going to want to lend that kind of money to them because the banks are gone. There'll still be some resources, but nothing like what there was in the literally half century, more than a century, that munis were part of banks' capital, safe capital. Let me show you here. Look at some of these munis. Here's a muni. It's a triple grade A. Look at this guy. Super grade A. 2% yield. It's essentially parked right on top of a U.S. Treasury bond. Both tax-free. They're essentially considered so safe that they are like buying a Treasury note, a 10-year Treasury note. That's how safe the markets consider them. But suddenly the Federal Reserve doesn't think they're safe enough for banks anymore. Well, isn't that interesting? Going down, though, a little bit, if you look at the double A's, on a double A, you'll get a credit risk spread 2.13%. But notice that a double A corporate pays 3%. The reason being that there has to be a higher percent for an investor in a taxable instrument than there would be for an investor in a non-taxable instrument. See, this guy, the investors will get their coupons, they won't pay any tax on it. The people who invest in this, they'll get their coupons and they'll pay tax on it. That's why the yields on them are higher, to compensate for the tax difference. So if you're a rich investor who can benefit from the tax shield, you might go with this guy right here, the muni. But if you're a lower income investor, your marginal tax bracket isn't going to be that much anyway, so the tax hit from 3% isn't going to be that bad for you. So you would be more likely, better advised, to go with an equally risky, fully taxable bond than you would be an equally risky, untaxed bond. So these are rich people's products. These are for wealthier, higher marginal tax bracket investors, both individual and corporate institutional. But anyway, moving down the line here, as you look at it, you will notice, by the way, am I seeing something? Wait. Is that a negative? That's a negative yield. Here's a rule. Yield should not be negative. Well, I'll be a son of a bitch. In other words, if you lend the government money for 3 months, you have to pay them for it. No, seriously, noobs, that's not right. That you the lender should get money back. But the yields are so low that they're negative. In other words, well, damn. Ha! That's almost disconcerting right there. I'm going to go away from that. That's just not, that's bad karma. Okay, let me do market data bonds. I'm going to show you real quick here. I am fines. Seriously, how hard is it just to get a darn bond quote? A bond quote. Bond. Where can I find Brady? James Bond quotes. What the hell? Seriously, go home, Google. You're drunk. All I want is a stupid bond quote. Okay. Oh, composite bond rates. Okay. I'm still not getting what I want, and for some reason, FINRA is being difficult by not showing me my bond prices that I want to see. Corporate bonds, where can I find bonds? No, I don't want to know where I can find them. Okay, stocks and bonds, bonds online. Okay, maybe I can do it here. I do definitely want you to see a bond quote. Okay, bonds. Treasury bonds, preferred stock, corporate bonds, spreads, corporate agency bonds. Let's have a look. Oh, they're going to give me a bunch of definitions. Goody. Anyway, the point, I'm just going to let it drop there. But by the way, agency. Oh, that's one last one. God, I'm glad they showed that to me. Agency paper is actually government paper, but it's not part of the normal borrowing cycle of the Treasury. The United States has a number, government has a number of agencies that actually are like almost like on their own for raising money. One of those that's a famous one is the Tennessee Valley Authority. But there are quite a few of these agencies out there. They borrow money on their own, on their own, on terms the market works out with them, investors. They're considered quite safe instruments. Agency debt is considered quite safe. It's essentially, it is not explicitly backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. However, most investors assume that if one of these agencies got in trouble with paying its bills, the U.S. government would step in. So by default, we assume that, yeah, this agency debt, even though it doesn't say it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, it is, we hope. Here's the interesting thing about it, though. Agency debt is not counted in the debt deficit and debt figures of the national debt. When we see, well, our budget deficit or our national debt is, unless you go to the right place to find your numbers, that does not count agency debt. All of these government agencies that borrow money on their own, it's technically part of the government's total debt load, but almost never would you see that counted in the total debt figures. What has agency debt done over the years? Interestingly enough, it went up rather dramatically in the early 2000s. I'm not so sure it's gotten too much worse since then, but it does represent a rather significant little extra that you don't know is part of our national debt. So, if I were to show you that here, and I bookmarked it, and all my bookmarks got wiped out the last time I was here. So, National Debt Agency. Okay. Okay, now, well, interestingly enough, the U.S. national debt. Oh, God, I might as well go to the Cato Institute. Let's do the debt clock. I hate this chart. Okay? hundreds, thousands, millions, billions, trillions. In other words, paper outstanding. Paper outstanding. Government debt instruments out there in the world, in the hands of investors right now, stand at $18 trillion. Of that, $13 trillion is owed to the public. Now, who else would own it? Who else would own that debt? Is there anyone else who might own it? Geez. Okay, I got it. Okay, I get it. This was fun. The monetary base. You can look at these numbers. I remember this site. People run this are crackpots, but it's actually a very interesting thing. Okay? Look at that. What you see is happening to the budget deficit. In other words, the year to year, how much we add to the national debt. Clearly, we're adding to it, 100,000 million billion. But what do you see is happening to the national, the budget deficits? Look. It's closing. It is slowly closing. Back like it started to do early in 1993. You're beginning to see it narrow again. So that's an interesting thing right there. And this is one of those places where we've had a relative stability of tax rates for a while. And we've got some kind of a business environment that's beginning to show some strength. That means tax revenues are going up. And that means that our expenditures are staying fairly level. We're backing out of wars, things like that. And our expenditures haven't blown up in our faces. So what you're seeing happening is that the amount of paper that the government is issuing is still staggering. But the rate at which it is issuing paper is going down. In other words, how much is going to the auctions is declining. So there is an interesting thing, too, because if the Federal Reserve starts to contract the money supply, it would start selling paper, treasury paper, to the banks to get their money. But if that treasury paper is beginning to get in shorter supply, that would mean that the paper should be going up in price. So the Fed's moves would have to be awfully careful, because if it starts selling paper that's going to the banks, that's going to cause some interesting volatility in the markets that would otherwise not be there. But right now, look at that. In the time that you've been sitting here looking at that one, the amount of paper, again, this is selling paper by the government that's borrowing money, that's issuing bills, notes, bonds, treasury. But the rate at which it is doing it is narrowing. Again, that's a very healthy sign, but it can be disrupted by when the markets get spooked by all kinds of things. Right now, our tax revenues are going up. Our expenditures are staying relatively stable, which means that our budget deficits can narrow. And that's what will happen whenever you have stable tax rates and a positive business environment. You disrupt that. You start talking about some ridiculous new war or new spending plan or some insane, puffy-haired maniac, failure as a businessman, having a brilliant idea for a new tax system. Then all of a sudden, all bets are off. Right now, we're sitting on a precipice. We're teetering like this, and we're actually kind of coming this way. That's when you say, everyone shut up and let it keep going back this way. Keep that in mind. That's all I have for you today. Thank you.